Blog Talk Radio.
Kalana was born in 1838. Henry George, the land reformer, was born this day. Albert Spalding, remember Spalding golf ball, Spalding basketball, Spalding sports equipment? He was born in 1850. A real progressive, not the closet communist. Hiram Johnson was born in 1866. Excuse me. And he's part of that crowd, Fiorello, LaGuardia, George Norris. Those were real progressives. They were also racist. They believed in Oriental exclusion. That meant the Chinese were limited in emigrating to the United States. Indians were to be kept on reservations. And also, they did not have citizenship. And prostitution, red light districts were banned. This happened in California. Great Swedish Wagnerian tenor sang often with the great Norwegian soprano, Kirsten Flagstad. Seth Svetholm is his birthday today. Writer, and he was into animal rights, Cleveland Amory, his birthday. If you remember, Advise and Consent, and a lot of the political thrillers written by Alan Drury. Martha Mitchell, she was the wife of John Mitchell, and she used to make those phone calls until they shut her up during the Watergate scandal. In 1948, Sharon, that was her first name, Krista McAuliffe, was the first woman to fly in the Challenger, which blew up during the Reagan administration. among the deaths today, Hernando Cortez, and the guy who revived the first modern Olympics, Baron de Coubertin, died in 1937. Among the events today, the Naval Battle of Antium, where Octavian later became Augustus Caesar. He defeated Mark Antony's naval ships, Egyptian Navy. In 1490, we had the first marathon where a Greek runner ran to Sparta to seek aid, military aid, to defeat the Persians. In 1789, the Treasury Department was established. 1864, Sherman, General Sherman, Union Army, captured Atlanta, and we haven't forgiven him ever since. In 1898, a British general, Lord Kitchener, reached out to Sudan after the defeat of Chinese General Gordon. General Gordon was actually British, but that was his nickname. In 1901, Teddy Roosevelt utter this statement, speak softly, but carry a big stick. Of course, now we have Mr. O speaking loudly, not carrying any stick. 1919, this is interesting, the Communist Party was organized in Chicago. I didn't know that one. In 1930, the first nonstop plane trip from Europe to the United States took about 37 hours. I must have been flying awfully slow or a lot of fuel. In 1936, the first round the world airline trip or air trip. 1944, back to World War II, Anne Frank was sent to Auschwitz. In 1945, Ho Chi Minh demanded, or actually he spoke, that he made a speech in which he said Indochina, which was North and South Vietnam, had declared its independence from France, and then we got the Vietnam War. In 1945, the Japanese, with VJ's official surrender, the Japanese surrender aboard USS Missouri. We'll play that tape in a minute. But I want to get back, I promise you, since this is Labor Day, and there are a lot of things that occurred on this day, Huey Long talked about, he was the senator from Louisiana, started the Long family politicians. His brother Earl Long was governor. Huey Long's son, Russell Long, was a longtime senator from Louisiana. And Huey Long said that there was the started to share the wealth, which is a union idea of Occupy, and we'll play an audio tape that we interview of a descendant of one of the founders of the American labor movement. But right now we will play, which was delayed last week, we'll play Huey Long's speech about sharing the wealth.
According to the tables which we have assembled, it is our estimate that 4% of the American people own 85% of the wealth of America, and that over 70% of the people of America don't own enough to pay the debts that they owe. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business with. Now, how are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. Give them a yacht. Give them a palace. Send them to Reno and give them a new wife when they want it, if that's what they want. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat and they can wear and they can live in, and all that their children can live in and wear and eat, and all their children's children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Put that stuff back on this table here that you took away from here, that you don't need. Leave something else for the American people to consume. And that's the problem. We're not going to destroy the Gulf Refining Company. We're not going to destroy the Standard Oil Company, but we're going to say that the limit of any one man's stock ownership in the Standard Oil Company is from $3 to $5 million to that individual, and that the balance of the people of America own the balance of what the Standard Oil Company is worth. All right. Then we start from the bottom, that the 25 or more million American families shall have a homestead, a home, and the comforts of a home, including an automobile and a radio, the things it takes in that house to live on. We say to America, 125 million, none shall be too big, None shall be too poor. None shall work too much. None shall be idle. No luxurious mansions empty. None walking the streets. None impoverished. None in pestilence. None in want. But in the land blessed by the smile of the Creator, with everything to be consumed, to be eaten, to be worn, that America will become a land sharing the fruits of the land, not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in a land in which the Lord has provided an abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in general, I think.
Long record.
Now, after Senator Long lambasted the Rockefellers, the Mellons, all those people, he took on both parties. He was a Democrat, but this is what he said. There's no difference between the Democrats and Republicans. Here's that little speech excerpt.
The Democratic Party and the Republican Party were just like the old patent medicine drummer that used to come around our country. He had two bottles of medicine. He'd play a banjo and he'd sell two bottles of medicine. One of those bottles of medicine was called Hypopalora. And another one of those bottles of medicine was called Lopapahara. Finally, somebody around that said, is there any difference in these medicines? Oh, he said, considerable. They're both good, but they're different. He said, that Hypopalora is made from the bark off the tree that we take from the top down. And that Lopapahara is made from the bark that we take from the root up. And the only difference that I have found between the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership was that one of them was skinning from the ankle up and the other from the ear down when I got to Congress.
Well, that was Huey Long. That was during the Depression, and he was going to run for president, but he was assassinated by a doctor. And, of course, there's a great movie called All the King's Men, starring Broderick Crawford, which gets into Huey Long's life, but they don't call him Huey Long. They didn't want to get sued by the family. Now, we did promise to run this debate. We had a little problem. Huey Long, who was not Huey Long, Raymond Massey, part of the famous Canadian manufacturing family that made tractors, Massey Ferguson, that later brought John Deere, which was out of Illinois. Raymond Massey immigrated to the United States, made many films, and you probably remember him in Dr. Kildare. And this is what he said in the, oh, we don't want that one, when he ran, let's see if we can find this. He supported Goldwater, and this comes up again today about, you know, are the conservatives going to oppose some of the things that the radical, I guess you could call them Democrats, although there's no difference between the two, as Huey Long said. But it's time that, you know, that we what Lord Acton said, it's time to pay attention to this, that the both American political parties, the Democrats and Republicans, are like two empty bottles with different labels on them. And, of course, they're all scratching one another's back, and they're all keeping tabs on who's got the most dirt. And this appears to be what goes on in Washington, and it's time for term limits for everybody, from judges on down. Among the other things today, the question, we hear he's now Secretary of State, his former senator from Massachusetts. John Kerry offered a photo which has been exposed as a fraud. This photo, which he claims is of Syrians who have been attacked with chemical weapons, I guess their corpses. Well, that photo dates from 2003, according to the intelligence sources, and it's not of Syrian dead who were attacked with chemical weapons, but of Kurds. And when Saddam Hussein in 2003 used chemical weapons on the 3rd, now where was Senator Kerry then, because he was in the Senate. Where was Mr. Rowe about this time? Excuse me. I think he was in the Senate too, one term. So maybe he voted present. We don't know. But, you know, this is reminiscent of what happened in 1939 in August, just before September 1st, when Hitler declared war on Poland because allegedly Polish soldiers attacked a radio station on the German side of the Polish-German border, the Greenwich incident. And on September 1st, they had the Nazis had their pretense to invade Poland, and this started World War II. And this type of operation is called false flag. Now, is this what's going on right now? Also, in the Vietnam War, I think it was the USS destroyer Maddox, which Lyndon Johnson's administration claimed that Vietnamese gunboats had fired on the USS Maddox. This was known as the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And, of course, this was used to justify the Vietnam War. So do we have another situation like this using a phony photo or a photo from 2003 when we weren't at war with, we didn't have this confrontation with Sadat, Assad, excuse me, getting my Arabs mixed up. Also, there's a picture of John Kerry having lunch or dinner with Assad. And he was a nice guy and all that. And all of a sudden, for purposes of today's political propaganda, he's a thug. There's some explaining these people need to do. People are tired of war, and we are like the British and the Roman empires, all the great and famous empires of the world. They've been bled dry throughout history of all these military adventures. The Britain after World War I was bled dry, and World War II finished off the British Empire. The Spanish lost theirs after the Spanish-American War. The Romans were overextended, and now we're not even 300 years old, and we're all over the world, and they want us to be policemen or National Guard of the world or the Universal Soldier. This is crazy. We don't have the money. So these are things we need to be thinking about. I'm trying to find the interview today that also, on September 2nd, 1945, the Japanese signed the documents of surrender aboard the USS Missouri. And let me find, I have so many interviews here. Let me find this from our archives, this episode. And I know it's here. We also have our Occupy, our young descendant of one of the founders of the American labor movement. I cannot use his name. That was the deal. He works for a non-union shop, and I don't want him to lose his job. Great guy, though. And he has to work two jobs. He should be here. He is Jim. I think this is it. Wait a minute. Yeah, here we go.
That's the beep. Okay, Jim, now you descend among your ancestors, whose names we will not mention, are among the illustrious Union people who tried to, at 100 years ago or so, try to help American workers achieve the rights that they were being denied in the workplace. When you were growing up, did your family ever talk about your great ancestor?
It was a subject that was more, you know, geared toward the my father, not so much, more my grandfather, who felt a strong identity to that particular branch, which pertained to being recognized for something as, you know, like just going in, you know, going into a union for, you know, for bakers or something like that, immediately like being, you know, being recognized and for, you know, for being like part of like a lineage of great movers and shakers for a very important time, post-industrial revolution in America.
Ah, so you grew up with this heritage. When you first learned about this, how old were you?
I was about roughly, I want to say, about 11, 12, around there. And
okay, was it a surprise, or did you talk to your schoolmates, your playmates about your illustrious history and your family's?
No, it's one of those things. I mean, I remember thinking that I had an Aunt Diana, and I thought for the longest time that she was Princess Diana of Wales. So it's one of those things at that age you kind of jumble together the names that you hear from like, I think, within your like familial and inner circles of prestigious names. Outside of that, that are on a more secular, larger scale, and it's something that kind of occurs, through the process of cognitive development over in adolescence, and then you start to realize and understand, I think, where history, personal and outside of that, and where that all comes together. So, I didn't think at the time it meant simply that I was related to someone someone who helped create reform for systems of working governance and so forth.
Now, you're a college graduate. What when you went to a public university, did that affect your thinking about unions or what the economic situation in America today or in the world?
Well, I'm not so certain that I think that there was really. There was a more than anything. I felt it was just the completion of a kind of some sort of a semblance of a classical education that I felt was denied from the your typical K through 12 paradigm. But I don't know if there was much that talked about at the university, the public university, like, level or enrichment of that. I mean, definitely if I was pursuing more, I think, economic emphases of an education, I probably would have been like more focused, whereas I was more intrigued in the functions of the written word and dynamics.
Well, your major is not social sciences. What's your major, English?
English, yes.
Okay. Well, did you take any courses of, say, American history, where your ancestor and the movement that he was involved in? Did you take any courses where that was part of the course, the history of unions?
Not so much. It's not something that's typically. I mean, it's very interesting. I think it's such a curriculum subject. I mean, there's a lot of the biggest focuses I felt for U.S. history and even for world history, but more pertaining to U.S. history was even on the college level, just even over things are so, and the blue book structure is so concerned about being able to regurgitate overviews as opposed to getting into dynamics that typically are like glossed over in favor of the recognition of the individual over the sum of the people that make up, that helped this individual. Like, say, a great example would be like a Henry Ford character. You're not really thinking about the people that are on the assembly line. Those stories and those songs aren't sung, but rather what you hear about is, either Henry Ford the Great, Henry Ford the Model T, or Henry Ford the controversial and correct, the Henry Ford the Fascist and the this too. Those particular like polemics, nobody cares about the John Doe that went out on a work injury or something like that from the assembly line, or had, prevented his family from achieving, that picket fence. And so they, lived in a cramped one bedroom studio. And, it's a very, the it's a deep, those are a lot of, it's, the devil's in the details and the order.
Well, in fairness to Henry Ford, though, by inventing the assembly line, he made it possible to bring down the cost of cars and bring it at the price level within the earning ability of the individual American to be able to buy that, what was it, $700 for a Model T, and you can only get it in black, you know?
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, there is a kind of a benefit, even though Henry Ford later became a fascist and embraced some controversial political views and got involved in some things which we would reject today. Now, you're of the generation, I'm a generation before you and of the 60s. Now, you're of a generation of what, the 80s?
We will have part two of this interview later in the week, since this is labor, we're commemorating America's labor pains. Now we're going to, since this is the anniversary of the Japanese surrender on board the USS Missouri, General MacArthur, it's our relationships with Japan, especially with this nuclear disaster at Fukushima, is going to affect our fishing industry on the West Coast. You may as well have crabs now, because that's the type you eat, because it's going to be they're going to be irradiated with this Fukushima mess that's coming our way because of the currents in the ocean and other fish, tuna, and people. It's as interesting, I'm talking to somebody who works at one of the big chains here on the West Coast, a restaurant, a coffee shop chains, and they're saying the same thing, that they are cutting back on their tuna. People are not using them, are not consuming them, and also shrimp. The disaster with the shrimp that occurred in, quote, the Gulf of Mexico. You know, people don't believe that it's safe to eat that stuff. So we may all become vegetarians. And I wanted to, got to get it here, the Japanese surrendered today. Let me see. I've got to reorganize. We have so many interviews that I think it's important that we remember what happened in one of the worst wars in world history. Excuse me. And that we should never forget, and this whole business about would you believe they're not going to be boots on the ground? We don't know. Once you start these things, they acquire a life of their own. We remember that World War One, the British went off thinking and singing it's going to be a splendid little war. I think that's the lyrics of one of the songs. Also, the fact that World War Two, we thought that the Japanese thought that once they knocked out our fleet at Pearl Harbor, that we would stand down. So here we go, the archives of the Japanese surrender aboard the USS Missouri.
It's Sunday, September 2nd, 1945. Cameramen and reporters of many countries record this historic moment as United Nations military leaders crowd aboard the Missouri and examine souvenir cards bearing the Japanese flag, special mementos of the occasion. And now, in a Navy launch, the Japanese surrender party arrives. They are headed by aged Mamoru Shigemitsu, foreign minister of the Japanese surrender cabinet, who was wounded by a Korean patriot in Shanghai years ago and walks on an artificial leg. Delegation lines up on the opposite side of the surrender table from the Allies. A war which had entered its eighth terrible year in China, which had raged for 3 years and 9 months for America and Britain, which was the brutal, costly eastern half of the most horrible worldwide war in human history, is now within minutes of ending for good. General MacArthur speaks.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese imperial forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. As Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, I announce it my firm purpose, in the tradition of the countries I represent, to proceed in the discharge of my responsibilities with justice and tolerance, while taking all necessary dispositions to ensure that the terms of surrender are fully, promptly, and faithfully complied with. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
Mr. Shigemitsu comes to the surrender table. These dramatic first pictures were made by newsreel war correspondents and Army and Navy cameramen, and were specially flown back from Tokyo. The time is 9.05 a.m. The Japanese have been on board exactly 10 minutes. General Yoshijiro Umetsu of the Imperial General Staff signs for the Japanese Army. The surrender documents, by which Japan agrees to lay down arms completely and to obey all Allied orders issued by General MacArthur, were printed by the Army on rare parchment found in a basement in ravaged Manila. General MacArthur signs as Supreme Allied Commander. The first pen used is presented to General Wainwright of Corregidor. The second pen to British General Percival, commander at the surrender of Singapore. MacArthur uses six pens in all, affixing what will be the most important signature in Japan to the document that ends permanently that nation's regime of terror and aggression. Forces of the United States itself, Admiral Chester Nimitz signs. Behind Nimitz are the Third Fleet's Admiral Halsey and Admiral Sherman, famed amphibious commander. General Su Yung Chan, Chief of Military Operations for the Chinese National Council, signs for China. Admiral Sir Bruce Fraser, commander of the British Pacific Fleet for the United Kingdom. Lieutenant General Kumza Nikolaevich Derevyanko for Soviet Russia. General Sir Thomas Blamey for Australia. Colonel Lawrence Moore Cosgrave for Canada. General Jacques Leclerc, hero of Africa and Paris, for France. Admiral C.E.L. Helfrich for the Netherlands. Air Vice Marshal L.M. Issat for New Zealand. Concluding the brief history-making ceremony, General MacArthur expresses a wish.
Let us pray that peace, be now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
Swarms of United States aircraft fly in formation overhead as the ceremony ends. The final United Nations victory has been won. The war is over. Peace is here.
We'll end with politics and poker, and I did promise there was other interviews. We'll be back Wednesday and with part two of the descendant of one of the founders of the American labor movement. But everybody plays politics, and maybe more should play poker.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bets.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
Ship.
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight. Possible flush.
Number three to me.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How about we should make Jack Riley the guy?
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of Jack, bet up.
Politics and poker, politics and poker, shuffle up and cards and find the joker. Need a game for children, need a game is rough. Decisions, decisions, like
who to pick,
how to play,
not to bet,
when to call up.
All right now, fellas, politics or poker, which is more important?
Parrot raise.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your five.
I'll call.
I'll fold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in. Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try Michael Fanyashinkovich. I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out. I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen and George is in jail.
We could run out Wallenstein.
He's only 23.
What about Ed Peterson?
You idiot!
Politics and poker, politics and poker, playing for a pot that's mediocre. Politics and poker, running neck and neck. If politics seems more predictable, that's because usually you can stack the deck. Politics and poker, politics and poker, makes the average
Peter Paul Rizzola. We ran a little over. We'll be back Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site. We have an update on the $1.50 bus trip from San Francisco or Northern California to Los Angeles and Las Vegas. So go to AMICUSVERITAS YouTube, and we'll have an update on reconstructing our blog, AmicusVeritas.net. It's a reconstruction we're still working on. So AMICUSVERITAS.net. Have a happy remainder of Labor Day weekend, and we'll have more celebrating, commemorating America's labor pains. Good night.